Please open your Bibles at Ecclesiastes chapter 2. We're going to be focusing our attention this evening on the first 11 verses that were read for us a few moments ago. All of the hymns and songs that we have sung to this point in the service express a longing, a yearning, a desire for more of Jesus Christ, that we might know him more, that our relationship with him might deepen, that he might be our greatest treasure, that we would not be diverted by the many pleasures and things that we have around us in the world today. So we sang, "Fairest Lord Jesus." What we're saying there is that there is no one that deserves my worship more than him. We sang of being a deer that is panting after the water, that longing that Jesus would be my only heart's desire. And that is leading us into this study in chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes. The preacher is wrestling with the realities of living in a broken and fallen world, a world that is not as God intended it to be. And you remember that he refers to living in this world as being under the sun. And as he looks around him, as he evaluates what's going on in the world and tastes and sees what the world has to offer, his conclusion is that ultimately everything is vain. It's futile. It's passing. It's like sand that runs through your fingers. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that life is meaningless. It doesn't mean that there is no good or beauty or joy in the world. But what it does mean is that such good things cannot ultimately satisfy the longings of the human heart. So as we come together to chapter 2, the preacher poses a crucial question. Is there anything in the world that can truly satisfy the heart of a human being? We could express that question another way. Will our thirst for satisfaction be quenched by the tainted joys and pleasures of this world in which we live? Now, it's important for us to recognize that, wittingly or unwittingly, we all subscribe to the philosophy that what's going to ultimately satisfy us is more of what we already have. Think about it for a moment. For most of us, there was a time when we fervently prayed that God would give us things which we now have. And if we're honest, we now take those things for granted. There was a time that we prayed for a job, or a better salary, or a house, or a spouse, or a family. And now that we have those things, we're still not satisfied. There's still a yearning and a longing in our hearts. Each of us can say to ourselves, if I just had, fill in the blank, then I'd be happy. Then I'd be satisfied. And that blank could be the latest iPhone. It always amazes me that people sleep on pavements in order to have the latest iPhone. And those same people were sleeping on those same pavements 2 years ago for the last iPhone, and that was supposed to satisfy them. But of course, it doesn't. Could be a new house, a promotion at work, a new relationship, and on we go. And we've been like this since we were children. We soon got bored of our Nintendo Game Boys and our PlayStation 1s, and we were longing for the next new thing to come out. We were eager to get the latest model whenever it became available. But why is that? It's because nothing under the sun ultimately satisfies the human heart. We think that we need more to be happy, but when we accumulate more, we're still not happy. This is the kind of philosophy that the preacher is trying to expose for us in chapter 2. And as we'll see, he was a man who had it all, and when he'd seen and done it all, he came away empty. Now, before we start to get into the passage, it's important to say right at the beginning that all the things the preacher mentions here aren't necessarily bad things. Pleasure and joy aren't bad things. But because of the fall, they can't be our final guide. They can't be ultimate in our lives. So pleasure and joy and the things that we're going to read of are good things that if we turn them into a God thing, if we turn them into an ultimate thing, become an enslaving thing. Now, I just want to unpack the passage by showing you four things that don't ultimately satisfy. Four things that don't ultimately satisfy. And the first we have in the first three verses, ultimate satisfaction doesn't come through pleasure, through what we enjoy. See what the preacher says. I said in my heart, come now, I'll test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it's mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. Hedonism is one way to describe what we're looking at here in chapter 2. It's the pursuit of pleasure, especially the pleasures of the senses. And the preacher engages headlong in this pursuit of pleasure. He adopts the mantra of many today, let's eat, drink, and be merry. And it's worth remembering that he's already sought meaning and wisdom. We saw that last week, and he found that to be wanting. So now he continues to pursue pleasures of various kinds in order to satisfy this aching void in his heart. He's a bit like the person who's received a terminal diagnosis from the doctor and in response rushes out and engages in all kinds of crazy ventures and activities in order to escape from the realities of life. But the great irony is that pleasure alone can never bring true satisfaction because it only appeals to our senses. It can't provide a solid foundation for our lives. These things look like they're going to make us happy, but they won't. What are these things? Well, first of all, he turns to laughter and to comedy. And he finds no real profit in either. In fact, he says, laughter is mad. It's madness. Now, as we've already said, laughter is one of the good things that God's given us. It's a wonderful gift. And if you turn over to chapter 3 and verse 4, the preacher reminds us that there is a right time and a right place to have a good laugh. You know, a good belly laugh. A time when it's right to express our joy in life through our laughter and through joy expressed in that way. My parents used to subscribe to the Reader's Digest. And as a boy, I always enjoyed when it came through every month, turning to the funnies page. What was it called? Laughter is the best medicine. And there's an element of truth in that. We can well understand that sentiment. But even though laughter's a good thing, it can't fully satisfy us under the sun. The wise man in Proverbs 14:13 says this, even in laughter, the heart may ache. Now, if you've read any of the biographies of some of the great comedians of our time, you'll recognize that that is true. Think of people like Tommy Cooper, if you're of that generation, a clown, a funny man. But boy, he had heartaches and depression and pain that lay behind it. Think more recently of Stephen Fry, a very gifted and talented man, but with great struggles and heartaches. But what does the preacher mean when he says that laughter is mad? Well, laughter's mad or foolish when we use it to escape or to justify our sin or to justify our folly. You see, the escapist is always laughing, always joking, always giggling, trying to divert from the seriousness or the solemnity of the situation. Laughter can be a great blessing, and many of us need more of it. But while we live under the sun in this broken world, tears and joy are always going to be mixed. Laughter can't ultimately save. It also needs to be redeemed. So that doesn't satisfy him. So then he turns to alcohol. He turns to wine, to see if it can bring him lasting satisfaction. And the answer, of course, is a resounding no. Now, it's likely that he enjoyed wine for its own sake. You know, he enjoyed a good glass of Beaujolais or whatever while not overstepping the mark. But I think there are also indications that he went as far as indulging himself to the point of being drunk. Either way, wine, a good thing, which God gave to gladden the heart, became at times a bad thing, and ultimately couldn't give him the satisfaction that he sought. And like many people today, the preacher found that his continued pursuit of satisfaction from a bottle, or a pill, or a joint, or mainlining drugs, or snorting cocaine, or whatever, actually led to more pain than pleasure. Now, it's important that we think about that for a moment. Why is that? Well, it's very simple. Repeatedly doing something that brings you joy is necessary in order to maintain the desired results. If you enjoy that high, you want to keep enjoying that high, whether it's chemically induced or whether it's something that you get through sex, as we'll see later. So the more people drink, the more they need to drink in order to maintain the high. The more people use drugs, the stronger drugs they have to move into in order to maintain the same kick. And once again, we underline wine and beer are good gifts of God. But our continual search for happiness leaves us thirsty. Yes, there may be modest enjoyment of a good glass of wine, a heart-lifting delight in something, but it never, ever gives us the satisfaction, the fulfillment, the joy that we were created for. Woody Allen, the filmmaker, has been in some trouble lately. In fact, he's been in trouble through the years in various ways for unwise decisions and all the rest of it. But listen to one thing that he said in a recent interview. He said, "It's hard for me to enjoy anything because I'm aware how transient things are." It's like he's read Ecclesiastes. He goes on, he says, "Yes, there are strategies of surviving. There are times when you think, my God, life is sweet, it's nice, and thoughts of immortality or mortality are in abeyance. You know, watching the Marx Brothers or a Knicks game." I mean, that must be some kind of American sport. Or listening to great jazz. You get a great feeling of ecstasy. But then it passes. And the dark reality of life starts to creep back in. And that's exactly what the preacher found in his pursuit of satisfaction through laughter and wine and pleasure. Every pleasure is diminished by the knowledge that it doesn't last and by its inability to satisfy us completely. Sooner or later, we wake up with a hangover, with a sore head, and we're left with the same problems that were there the day before. And that comes as cold water all over us. But we're not finished yet. The second thing here, ultimate satisfaction doesn't come through projects, what we do. Look at verses 4 to 6. See what he says, "I made great works, I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks, planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees." So this man was a man of great ability. And he invested his energies, his creative powers in all kinds of projects, hoping to discover something that would make life worth living. Something that would bring him ultimate satisfaction. Now, if this man was Solomon, his great works included many, many things. The building of houses and cities. He talks of making gardens and vineyards and planting orchards and forests. He talks about creating complex irrigation systems needed to service these gardens. You think of the construction of the temple in Solomon's time, one of the ancient wonders of the world. All of that offered no lasting pleasure. In fact, even after all those achievements, there was still that emptiness, that sense of no fulfillment, no satisfaction to be had. The hunger was still there. The thirst was still there. You know, history is filled with the names of people who made great discoveries, whose achievements were admirable, who enjoyed the world's acclaim, but in the end, there was no lasting satisfaction or happiness to be found. And notice something else. How frequently in these verses the preacher speaks in the first person singular. He talks about, I did this, and I did it for myself. His pursuit of satisfaction through what he did with his hands and his daily work and his creativity became self-focused and self-absorbed. And what did he find? That also led to futility. Listen to this statement made by a psychiatrist. He wrote, out of all the various personality types in our culture, there is one type that is more likely than any other to get depressed at some time in life. That type is the nice guy. The person who's self-sacrificing, overly conscientious, overly dutiful, hard-working, and frequently quite religious. Most laypersons will call him a perfectionist, or a workaholic, or even a dedicated servant. Yet while he is out in society serving humanity at a work pace of 80 to 100 hours a week, he is selfishly ignoring his wife and children. In his own eyes and in the eyes of society, he is the epitome of human dedication, while his wife suffers from loneliness. He becomes angry when his wife and children place demands on him. He can't understand how they could have the nerve to call such an unselfish, dedicated servant a selfish husband and father. In reality, his wife and children are correct, and they are suffering severely because of this subtle selfishness. This is precisely the reason why so many of the children of high achievers turn out to be rebellious. End of quote. The pace of life in this broken world has led so many busy people to give greater attention to machines and to jobs and to companies and to balance sheets than to the young lives that have been entrusted to their care, who long for some time with them. We call it quality time. There really is no such thing. Quantity time's what's needed. If we're to keep our children from being devoured by the ever-increasing pleasures of this world, then we had better learn to deny ourselves the selfish pleasures of being consumed by our commitments at the cost of our families. See, any pleasure that jeopardizes the sacred right of another is an illicit pleasure. Even your work, if you take it to the extreme, it's a good thing that becomes a God thing, and therefore it becomes a bad thing, and it does harm to those around you. Now, notwithstanding the fact that God has called us as his image bearers to take of the raw materials of creation and make things that are beautiful and functional, in the end, there's nothing to be gained under the sun, says the preacher. Yes, it's right that we delight in art and design and architecture and all forms of creativity. But there will be no lasting gain or satisfaction in any of those things. There's no salvation in the work of our hands, however great they may be, whether it's a work of art or a sculpture or a building or a landscape park or whatever. That's the second thing that doesn't satisfy. Let's see the third one. Satisfaction doesn't come through possessions, what we have. Look at verses 7 to 9. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of flocks and herds, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. So this man was astoundingly wealthy, and he could access and have and possess all the things that money could buy. He was richer than anyone else in the world, and as his fame grew, there was still no sense of meaning, no satisfaction to be had. He could go out and buy what he wanted, whatever his heart desired. And it's interesting that he had power over people. He owned many human beings alongside his other material possessions. Throughout history, human beings have this desire to own others, to dominate them, to have power over them, to dictate to them so that they serve our needs. This man was in that position. He could buy and sell people to service his needs. He was a power player, seeking satisfaction in that way. And we see similar power plays in the workplace today, when employers treat employees as if their livelihoods and personal lives depend on whatever the employer wants them to do. It's a similar kind of power play that we see in these verses. And then added to that, we have possessions and money. And that's the dream combination that many people in our world aspire to. But the preacher says, when all those things are added up and taken together, neither money nor power over people nor possessions could satisfy him or rescue him. Even worldwide fame didn't satisfy him. A few years ago, the New York Times reported about millionaires in Silicon Valley in California. And they put a piece in that indicated that these millionaires were struggling to make ends meet. They had a sense of economic insecurity. And this is how the paper explained it. By almost any definition, except his own and perhaps those of his neighbors in Silicon Valley, Hal Steger has made it. Mr. Steger, 51, a self-described geek, has banked more than $2 million. The $1.3 million house he and his wife own on a bluff overlooking the Pacific Ocean is completely paid off. The couple's net worth is roughly $3.5 million, and that places them in the top 2% of families in the United States. Yet, each day, Mr. Steger continues to toil in what a colleague calls the Silicon Valley salt mines, working as a marketing executive for a technology startup, still striving for his big strike. Most mornings he can be found at his desk by 7. He typically works 12 hours a day and logs an extra 10 hours over the weekend. He's getting close to a pastor with that. I know, he says, people looking in from the outside will ask why someone like me keeps working so hard, but a few million doesn't go as far as it used to. Maybe in the 70s, a few million bucks meant a lifestyle of the rich and famous, or Richie Rich living in a big house with a butler, but not anymore. And it goes on to talk about working class millionaires who are members of the digital elite and don't think of themselves as wealthy. And the writer explains, many such accomplished and ambitious members of the digital elite don't think of themselves as particularly fortunate, in part because they're surrounded by people with more wealth, often a lot more. So they play the comparison game. The comparison game. So the pursuit of wealth is like this. Here, the top 1% chase the top 1/10 of 1%, and the top 1/10 of 1% chase the top 1/100 of 1%. You try not to get caught up in it, but it's hard not to. He's involved in this comparison game. He has wealth that any of us would be amazed and happy to enjoy, but he's constantly comparing himself with someone else. He's just like John D. Rockefeller, who sort of said, well, how much more do I need to make me happy? And it's always a little bit more than I presently have. And the preacher looks at it, and he looks at his wealth, he looks at all his possessions, and he says, yes, I agree. All these things are not enough to bring lasting satisfaction. More than that, all the sex a man can manage didn't satisfy him either. Now, as we already know, sex is one of God's good gifts. But it doesn't promise or provide ultimate satisfaction. When we're preparing a couple to be married, one of the things we don't go into lots of detail about sex and that side of things, but one of the things we impress upon them is, it's not like it is in the movies. It's not like it is in the movies, because that's just fantasy, utter fantasy. Okay? Sex does not promise or provide ultimate satisfaction. And in his pursuit of satisfaction, the preacher here indulges in sexual pleasures. If this man was Solomon, as I believe him to be, we know that he had 700 wives. Now, I got in trouble this morning at the children's talk for suggesting that that was a good thing. But I said to the person who raised it with me, I'd have been in a lot more trouble if I said having 700 wives was a bad thing. So anyway, whether it was good or bad, we'll leave. All right? But he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now, the word concubine in Hebrew, it's not clear of the meaning of the word. But if you go to your Bible dictionary at home, what you'll find, you know, I've looked at five or six of them, and what you find is that a concubine is a woman who is given to a man simply for the purpose of sexual pleasure, like a secondary wife, quite literally a sex object. And so many people today are on an endless search for sexual pleasure, seeking sexual partners on Tinder or Grindr according to personal preference. And this insatiable desire is also leading to rapid advances in technology and artificial intelligence. There was a report in the Telegraph in the week that's just gone by that there are several companies building and marketing what are called pleasure bots or sex bots in order to satisfy the demand. The latest ethical challenge for Christians is this: can a human being form a sexual relationship with an android, with a soulless, lifeless machine? What do you think? How would you answer that challenge Christianly from Scripture? We're going to have to. Some of you are involved in, you know, these areas of medicine, and you're going to have to think about the ethics of what is going on today, all because of this insatiable desire that is within human beings that seeks its satisfaction in sex, among other things. Now, it may not be the case that the average person in Leeds has literally 1,000 sexual partners, but there are certainly those who have many more in their pornographic internet history or in their romance novels. They constantly search for a new illicit experience in order to be satisfied. But like the preacher, they come away empty. They come away disappointed. The high only lasts for a short time. The fourth thing that doesn't satisfy is in verses 10 through to 11. Ultimate satisfaction does not come through excess. Whatever we choose to indulge. See what we see in verse 10. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil that I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. This man let it all go. He truly tested himself with pleasures of any kind. Anything that he desired, he did. He denied himself nothing. He had the most success, the best houses, the most possessions, the richest lifestyle, the finest wines, the most incredible parties and feasts, the best landscaping, multiple servants, more money than any of us can imagine, military fame, popularity, endless entertainment, and as much sexual pleasure as anyone could handle or cope with. And the result is verse 11. I considered all that my hands had done, the effort, the toil that I invested in doing those things, and behold, all was vanity. It was striving after wind. It was like trying to get hold of the wind and contain it. There was nothing to be gained under the sun. Emptiness. Even though he played out every single one of his fantasies in life, nothing fulfilled. Isn't it interesting you ask a question at a children's talk? Okay, if you could ask God for one question, what would you say? And somebody said, I want to be rich. Or I want to be a great footballer. I want to have fame. I want to be a celebrity. This is that man. He had all those things. He fulfilled all those fantasies. And he turned around and he said, oh, it's just empty. There's still this ache in my heart that I cannot get rid of. He's not alone. Again, another psychiatrist said this. We're convinced that many people do choose happiness, but still don't obtain it. The reason for this is that even though they choose to be happy, they seek for inner peace and joy in the wrong places. They seek for joy and sexual prowess, but end up with fleeting pleasures and bitter long-term disappointments. They seek inner fulfillment by obtaining positions of power, but they remain unfulfilled. I have had millionaire businessmen come to my office, tell me they have big houses, yachts, nice children, a beautiful mistress, an unsuspecting wife, secure corporate positions, and suicidal tendencies. They have everything this world has to offer, except one thing, inner peace and joy. They come to my office as a last resort, begging me to help them conquer the urge to kill themselves. Now, what are we to say about all this? Well, in his essay, The Weight of Glory, C.S. Lewis famously addressed our fruitless search for satisfaction. This is what he wrote. You've heard this before. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he can't imagine what's meant by the offer of a holiday by the sea, we are far too easily pleased. Even though there are countless pleasures in the world to be enjoyed, none of them can satisfy what only God can. 2 points to make as we come to an end. The first is this. Even if we were to use these pleasures moderately and wisely, even if we were to give thanks to God for them, we still have to reckon with the reality of life under the sun. Joy can't spare us from what inevitably happens under the sun. The wise will die just like the fool. And even if we're to turn from our making our mud pies to God, life won't necessarily reward us for that. Hedonism can't save us. Morality can't save us. Wisdom can't save us. Folly won't save us. Only a righteousness that comes from God can do this. The second thing is this. The preacher wants us to feel sad about this reality. He wants us to feel sad about the world in which we live. He wants us to honestly face the brokenness of this world. He wants us to see how far we've fallen. Did you notice in Verse 5. He says, I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. Where have you heard that phrase before? You've heard it back in Genesis, haven't you? When God created this world good and perfect and right. And there's a yearning, if you like, in what this man is doing to try and rewind the clock and get back to those days. He's trying to create a paradise on earth, but he can't do it. In the Garden of Eden, you remember, Adam and Eve were wholly satisfied with God and with the good gifts that God gave them. But it's not like that anymore because of their disobedience. Now, under the sun, even though we're surrounded by opportunities to laugh and to drink and to work and to make money, none of it's enough. We're never satisfied. And death takes it all. in the end. So death did this to us and to our world, and that should cause us grief. We are responsible, but God will deal with death and all its consequences. The preacher doesn't see this, but the yearning that he has will be satisfied. He knows that it is satisfied in God, but we have a fuller orbed understanding of that. Because in time, God will send the promised one. A cross will stand on Calvary's hill. The tomb will empty, and death itself will be conquered and die. You see, ultimate satisfaction, lasting joy, can only be found in Jesus Christ, the one who will one day redeem us and this broken world in which we live. That is our hope. That is our joy. That is the place of inner peace. Trusting Jesus, delighting in Him, not being distracted by all the good things around us, but always keeping our focus and our desires on Jesus, the one who is the author and finisher of our faith, the one who is the redeemer of us and our fallen and broken world. We're going to sing as we close a wonderful hymn that summarizes really where our hope lies. This desire that the Lord would be the vision of our hearts, that He would be the treasure that we pursue, that our satisfaction would be found in Him, that He would be our soul shelter, our high tower, the one who protects us, the one who brings us to heaven, the one who gives us power to live for His glory, the one who is our inheritance. Not possessions, not material things, but Jesus Himself. And we say, Thou and Thou only, the first in my heart, High King of Heaven, my treasure, Thou art. Let's stand and sing.